I was contemplating this series a couple of weeks ago. I thought, that's number 386 would be a good song to sing. Thanks, Warren, for forgot to mention to you. Speaking of forgetting, since the handouts have been kind of periodic, people come up afterwards, I forgot to pick up a handout, just walked right on by it. So you won't feel bad. I forgot to put the handout today because I'm not used to it. So if you want a handout, just raise your hand and stick the rest of them back there. While they're doing that, you can look at the picture up there. I thought this was a fitting metaphor, for what we're looking at. How often does a little kid get into a little swimming pool and figure, this is a safe area. I've been in here before. I go into a lot, splash around. There's no harm. There's no fish, whatever. And then to suddenly go out and find something emerge, from the depths that, shouldn't be there, but, you realize it's terrifying, it's perilous, that kind of stuff. And that's kind of like what life is. We go through life just kind of doing our normal thing, in our little bubble, in our comfort zone. And then every once in a while, we get something emerge that kind of rocks everything. And so this is what Paul has been warning us about, or warning Timothy about, is that, as they're going along, and Christianity was spreading quickly. It seemed like it had a nice little, window of opportunity for about 10 years. And then things begin to happen. And Paul is beginning to, through prophecy, to warn Timothy and at least his area about the impending problems that are about to occur. So it's not just like the world. It's a problem that's emerging in the church that he's warning them about. That's going to be... When it kind of blindsides us and hits us most. Now, I'm going to, as an introduction in the first part of this, I'm just going to skim through and get to someplace else. There's a nice little message in the last part of this that we can just dwell on and not take up too much time. In this, we covered last week the definition of what perilous times are going to be like, basically made up of the kind of people. Now, we're always going to have these kind of people, but it seems like in perilous times, they sort of group. You can get a momentum going and a leadership and everything else, and that became really fierce kind of times. So we looked at the definition of the people involved in that sort of thing. So this week, we're looking at, as Paul moves on in the context, to tell Timothy, this is what I do and what you need to do in order to get through those times. And so it becomes... also as a writing, a message for us too, because the times can be parallel now as to what's happening. Now Mike read from the context of verse 10, and here he says, "For among them there are those in their households and captivate weak women, weighed down with sins, led on by various impulses, always learning, never coming to a knowledge of the truth." And just as Jannes and Jambres opposed Moses by Jewish tradition, these are the two magicians that Moses contended with before Pharaoh. And so there's going to be like that. So men will also oppose truth, men of depraved mind, and so forth. Now, I'm going to move on through this and maybe use another illustration rather than all these things. Take us up to the next verse. every once in a while I get into the government stuff, and I don't know what your political persuasions are, which way you think the country should be going or whatever. What I like to use is an illustration of just why things are progressing the way they are, whether you agree with them or not. It depends on how you voted or whatever. But just how the things have changed since their founding fathers. What really set it off was the presidency of Woodrow Wilson. He was the only president who was an academic. He was the president of Princeton. He was the governor of New Jersey. And he was a prolific writer and arguer. And he's open about it. His view on what began as the progressive movement. A different kind of terminology other than liberal. Okay. People are moving away from the liberal. In fact, when Hillary Clinton was asked, "Are you a liberal?" she goes, "No, I'm a progressive." There's not much difference. You know, it's a move toward the government taking care of everything, getting bigger and whatever. But to start it off with, and this is where perhaps even in the church, Wilson said, you know, and the progression movement is this concept of we've moved away from, in our times, from the times of our founding fathers. And there's some legitimacy in this, and they feel that, you know, science has improved, and, you know, government, we know more about governments, you know, political science and stuff, and so we're better prepared to take care of things. But Wilson's main argument to get away from the founding fathers was, he said, forget about the opening statement as to why the Constitution exists. That is, as the Declaration begins, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. The founding fathers were trying to set up a government that would last through the ages because they set it up on principles divinely appointed. I mean, that's the way they looked at it. These are things that God said that we have a right to as human beings. And so they thought it was, you know, it would be universal then. You know, they allowed for changes in government, but they looked to God as, you know, the main director of it. And they thought, you know, his direction is timeless. So what Wilson had to do is get rid of that. Forget about God in it. And we'll talk about other things that, you know, people have rights to. And we'll promise. And of course, FDR was a disciple of Woodrow Wilson, as, you know, others that followed. So it had to get its start by getting rid of the concept of God's rules. And that'll happen in the church too. You know, when someone comes along and goes, well, the church is progressive, it has to keep up with the times, you know, we have to adjust the things. And the answer is, no, we don't. We used this illustration lately. You know, would you say, you know, we don't no longer need the sun because it's outdated? You know, we've moved beyond that in our technology. That really doesn't make any sense. Okay, God's plan is universal. His, you know, His will is universal. It's for the ages. It's forever. You can't get away from that, whatever men argue. You know, but Paul says, you know, basically that's what's going to happen in the church. And some of the progressive stuff is, you know, go back to liberal, you know, in the sense that it's crept in through colleges, through the media. I mean, they very intelligently have planned the last decade or the last century in remolding, you know, the concept of the United States. And very subtly, Paul says, they can do that with the church, if you let them. So here's Paul's answer. And again, I'm not going to take a political stand on this. In fact, if I had to, I'd probably go the opposite direction. There was a time when I thought, you know, theocracies, you know, really won't, you know, handle it. The more it gets there, the more I'm concerned about. If you ask me what's my political viewpoint, let's go back to being, you know, God is our king. Yeah, just do that. I think we'll have, you know, better luck, you know, in straightening out the human condition. So anyway, but this is what Paul tells Timothy. Here's his list. And first of all, he says doctrine. Okay. Paul kept on preaching the truth despite the times. You know, God's truth, keep it out there in front of them. Okay. Israel was destroyed, Hosea said, because of the lack of knowledge. They got away from the Ten Commandments, you know, the Mosaic Law. They didn't even know what it was about at some points. I mean, at the time of Josiah, you know, nobody had a copy of it. They found a copy hidden in the wall when they were, you know, breaking it down and renovating the temple. And that's how far they got away. But we're talking about like thousands of years too. So it's one of those things. So Paul made sure that Christians remain knowledgeable. Okay, and just as you know, if you ask kids in high school and college now anything about the founding fathers, the Constitution, they go, "What?" You know, they haven't got a clue. And so the church can get in the same direction. So we have to make sure that we maintain a knowledge of God's word. You know, we studied it daily. You know, and let it grow within us. Paul realized, you know, that was, you know, the foundation of all this. Second, he goes, in the manner of life. Okay, it's something, you know, one thing for me to preach the doctrine, but as a preacher, as a, you know, as teachers, you know, as elders, whatever, we have to live it, or it makes us hypocrites. Now, he always conducted himself in a godly manner. You could say nothing against Paul. I mean, there's other, you know, what we should be thankful for is that there are people that were accepted by God all the way through the Bible that had flaws. You know, Moses had some really dynamic flaws, so did Jacob and Israel, Isaac and Jacob, which is good for us, because if you look at their life, they go, man, what, you know, what a bunch of misfits. But he is the God of Isaac and Jacob and Abraham. Okay, so that means, you know, we don't have to be perfect, although you will find some individuals that are very out there. There's nothing said about Noah except that he was a man of righteousness and a preacher all his years. Nothing bad said about Daniel. I mean, this guy went through administration changes. Yeah, you know, and it's just, you know, he was flawless. You know, he had a secular job he had to do. He did it the best he could, was impressed by, you know, the Babylonians and Persians were both impressed with him, but still he stayed with, you know, his loyalty to God. Samuel was an incredible individual. We did a study of him. You know, here was a man that was tirelessly a statesman, a prophet, you know, a judge. I mean, you know, a lot of titles, and he carried them out, you know, with nothing bad said about him. And you get in the New Testament, there's individuals equally. You know, Paul, Peter had some flaws. You know, but John, you know, again, you know, there's nothing bad said about him. Yeah, so the illustration has to be there in our lives. And so he practices what he preached in order to fully illustrate what he was talking about and reinforcing his own teaching. I mean, you have to live in order for people to see. This is why Jesus came. Not to just, you know, to tell us things, but to show us the kind of man, the kind of thinking, the kind of individual we have to become. Purpose, Paul always sought to please God and reach others with the gospel. Okay, he also tried to instill goals in others so that they would remain strong with purpose and not just mill around subject to, you know, any kind of persuasion. And that's one of the things sometimes we lose about what we are. As we're studying Wednesday night, this is the kingdom of God. Now, what happens when one kingdom rubs up against another and they're not compatible? There's generally a war. And a lot of times we forget we are at war. You know, we need to support the kingdom of God and try to make advances in this world. You know, we can't look at the church as just a society club where we come, kind of mill around and talk to one another, you know, have what we call fellowship. Fellowship is a working together, understanding God's purpose and, you know, being there for one another as a kingdom, seeing how we can make inroads into the world and taking God's truth there. I mean, that's the ultimate weapon. We don't fight a physical war. We fight a spiritual war. And really, the spiritual aspect has more kind of dynamic and powerful armaments than a physical one does. I mean, the Greek nations pretty much fell apart and died early. But their ideals lived on. You know, the Romans picked them up. You know, we still have, you know, Western history is based on a lot of Greek philosophy. But Western history is also based on what is taught in the scriptures. And the apostles got it out, and this is you know, the best thing you can do is get the ideas out there. So even beyond our time, the church and the kingdom will still flourish and become even stronger as we put the ideas in people's minds and they compare it with the things that other nations are doing. And they'll see that, you know, God's, you know, kingdom is a light shining on the hill. I know the expression is often attributed to JFK or to Ronald Reagan or to, you know, some statesman in England, but they got it from the Bible. Yeah. Faith. He kept confidence in God and with his word. And that's what we need to do. Keep the faith, no matter what. I mean, it's our belief system. Okay, it makes us who we are. It instills us with character and a divine nature. We don't want to give that up. Long suffering. You know, as we begin to build the church, you know, we got people at all levels. We got people who've been in it for years that are hard studiers. You know, that are well versed in the scriptures, can teach others. And we've got new people that are coming in, and they're bringing a lot of world's ideas with them. They don't know enough to shed them. They're not even aware of them. And with Paul, you know, he said, you've got to be long-suffering. You know, be patient with them, work with them. He was always patient, enduring without retaliating against those who did him wrong. People need to be given time to adjust and learn and appreciate the things of the Lord. And we have to work with them so that they get to that point. Charity, he loved always acting in the best interest of others. This is how we need to react. You know, what you say to people, what you do, you know, is your utmost thought trying to be what do they need to hear in order to do the right thing? You know, we can see Christ acting. You know, for those that were very weak in the faith, he was very gentle. You know, he worked with them. The quotation from Isaiah, the smoldering wick he did not quench, the battered reed he did not break. He realized people were very fragile, their souls, and he worked with them. He went to sinners. But man, you give him a Pharisee who should know better, and is giving him a hard time, and he nails him to the wall. You know, you need to adjust. Okay. Again, Paul was very, you know, patient and everything else, but there are times, you know, almost on his first evangelistic journey, it's to Cyprus, and he has to run into the sorcerer, Elymas. What does he have to do? Blinds him. How unchristian is that? To get him to shut up so he can work on somebody else. Okay. A physical affront. But he couldn't have done it unless God was with him. You know, the apostles couldn't work miracles unless it was God ordained. Okay. So there are times when a little physical, you know, might be called for. Yeah. And this combative nature. Now, in Paul's life, I mean, he was a warrior. He was a, you know, temple warrior to begin with, you know, on the road. So a lot of this was instilled in him. But, you know, he knew how to change the fighting. At Ephesus, you know, when Demetrius the silversmith called a mob together, you know, and, you know, basically a lynch mob against Paul, it says that his friends had to hold him back from confronting them. You know, willing to take them on. Okay, we have to be ready for the fight. Of course, was he always that way? We know, was it Acts 18? There was a time when he was just, I attribute it to, you know, shell shock, battle fatigue, having undergone so much that he just, you know, he was kind of like a little fearful himself about staying in Corinth. He needed a vision from God to go, no, stay on. We got, you know, a lot of people here that still want to hear you, and you'll do some good work. But that kind of attitude you know, he explained some of the patience. He persevered and did not buckle under pressure. I mean, once you've been stoned to death and all the other stuff he went under, and to still, you know, shake it off, I mean, it's got to hurt to be stoned to death. I mean, when was the last time you were hit with a rock? And he was hit with a lot of them, big ones, you know, with cutting edges, you know, designed to break bones. In fact, I understand some scholars say that the initial stoning act begins with being pushed off of a cliff into a hole so that you can't get out, and then the rocks come in. And as far as they were concerned, the mob, they thought he was dead. I mean, he looked dead. And to get up after that and go back into the city and still begin preaching? With Paul, failure was not, you know, a lot of people use this expression, failure is not an option. With Paul, that was true. Okay, and for a better cause. Persecutions, he suffered, yet he overcame. Okay. Christians are told that all will suffer. Paul bought into this. I mean, a lot of people shy away from things where, you know, they want the comfort, they don't want to get hurt, whatever, and so in order to protect themselves, they'll not do certain things. But I know enough people in other realms that kind of look forward to the fight. They want to stay in the arena. They like the taste of blood. They like the hurt. It makes them feel alive. I mean, they don't wake up until they've been punched a couple of times and then get into it. Okay, spiritually, we need to buy into this. Okay, that we're going to get hurt? Right, great. I mean, for the Christian, you know, consider it all joy when you encounter various trials. I mean, that's when you know you're accepted by God, really, when you have to endure the trials. It lets you know that you're in the fight. And God is looking to you to do the right thing and to stand up for Him. That's the way Paul saw it. James 2. The reason is evil men will not go away. They're here. In fact, he goes, you think it's bad now? Guess what? It's going to get worse. So you might as well take a stand, you know, dig in and get ready for it. When you can, get proactive. We cannot ignore them. We must constantly be stuffing them back under their rocks and even pointing out, you know, even to the point of burying them there sometime. And people are coming out of the closet, push them back into the closet and keep them there. Get the word out. And don't let all the nonsense that people are talking about, you know, we'll be covering this Wednesday night, you know, the excuses they come up, you know, the emotional things that come up, just, you know, to not do what's right. And what else? And continue in 2 Timothy 3, verses 14 through 17, kind of famous. You, however, Timothy, continue in the things you've learned and become convinced of, knowing from whom you've learned them, that from childhood you have known the sacred writings. Yeah. Now, this is the sacred writings of the Old Testament. But notice what Timothy got even out of the Old Testament. If you shy away from a study of it, that's kind of a shame. You know, there's a lot in there to help bolster you, to help make you stronger, to make you understand the nature of God. Notice what he got from the sacred writings. Able to give you the wisdom that leads to salvation through faith which is in Jesus Christ. You got that from the Old Testament. So you're going to need even more in a study of the New. So, what he's telling them, remain in the truth. Just as I have, stay there yourself, get others to remain in the truth. Don't get sidetracked by everything that the world throws or its wisdom that we talked about this morning. Further, the truth will make you wise. It'll smarten you up. It'll teach you what you need to know to withstand, to become as good a fighter as Christ or, you know, Paul. In spite of the path of the world, verses 1 through 5, he was to continue in God's will. Doesn't matter what comes. Running with the herd doesn't necessarily mean salvation. I've talked to people that go, one guy was a Lutheran one time, and he goes, well, more people believe the way we do than the way you do. What's majority got to do with it? The majority is usually wrong. That's what you got to worry about. The more people you get together, it seems like the more people in a mob, it's like inversely proportionate to its IQ. The dumber it gets. The more it starts trashing things and killing things and whatever with no rhyme or reason. If you've seen some of the mob action in Los Angeles, people are breaking into stores. I saw one guy had a television set in his hand, and there's a cameraman taking a picture of him. And he stops and goes, "Hi, Mom," and keeps going. You do realize this is going to show up later in the police room. They know what you look like. But it doesn't matter. They don't even think about that. They're just having a good time. Everybody's doing it. Well, most of the world's going to go to the bad place. Do you really want to go with them? Perilous times come because men depart from the truth. It's not a better way away from God. It's a worse way. And you got to get that in your mind now. Don't do that. Okay. What God tells us not to do, there's various levels. When people see things that have happened, like in the news, shooting kids or wars or the towers getting bombed, whatever, they go, they start worrying about why does God let this happen? Well, there's multiple layers of this. And one of the reasons is there's certain courses that people take that is automatically a dead end. Okay, we talked this morning about the Greeks, see it as foolishness. Don't think of foolishness as silly. The definition of foolishness in the Old Testament, especially in the Proverbs, was that of a dead end. The fool chooses a path that's destruction. There's no sense to it. There's no rhyme or reason to it. There's no fruit in it. It brings them up to something that if they could see the end of it, they wouldn't go there. And this is what the world does. What God is trying to tell you on one level is the way things are set up, there's natural consequences to the choices you make. It matters what you believe in everything. So you got to be careful of this. When you start getting away from what God tells you, mostly he just tells you for your own good. He doesn't have to take a hand at it. He already has. This is the laws that are set up. You jump off a 10-story building? You really think I'm going to be there for you? I've already set up a law of gravity, okay? You can't get away from it. And you're going to do one of these for a long drop. Natural consequence. God didn't will it, but he's not going to stand in the way of it either. You should have known better. In fact, Jesus said, you can't tempt God. You can't go, I'm going to jump off a 10-story building. If you don't save me, I'm not going to believe in you. Well, by the time you hit the ground, you're not going to believe in anything. Okay, except maybe 10 seconds after, and you'll definitely believe in a God because you're going to be standing before him. Let's see. Why Timothy was to teach, reprove, correct, in contrast to verses 1 and 5, was allowing them to go with their own think so. This is something that Paul was struggling against with people. People have always got a think so, always got a way they want to do things. And God is telling us, you really don't want to go that way. Stay with my word, stay with my wisdom, let me direct you in this life. And your life will not be foolish. Not just the warning, but he can set us on a positive direction. And this is what we do with the scriptures. We put people in a positive direction so that life now is good, even in adversity. And they're prepared to step into the next life without adversity. And find the remedy to point people back to the inspired word. Okay? All scripture, given by inspiration of God, profitable for, you know, all the things that are there. Reproof, correction, you know, instruction in righteousness. That the man of God might be perfect, complete, thoroughly furnished into all good works. Okay? That's life. Full of good works. You know, shared by one another. You know? And as the world sees it, hopefully it's drawn into it. I mean, what we're doing, the kind of the inspired word of God is the answer to the problems, and it is. One of the things I was interested in is, in fact, some architects had a kind of a solution as to how do you stop crime in the city? And what they did was start to re-engineer, you know, the architecture of the inner cities. If you look at, okay, in this community, you've got a bunch of drug pushers on various corners. Well, why do they set up there? It's because if they see the police, they got various avenues of ways of getting out of there. So what you do is you redesign the community so that there is only one way out. And the police can adequately protect that. When Nancy and I were living in Coronado, I heard that there was a court case where a guy committed a robbery, and the police caught him right away because the only way out of Coronado is either down the Strand or over the bridge. There's no other way out. And so the argument of the lawyer was there was insufficient avenues of escape provided by the city. And the judge went, what? But what the engineers would find, you know, if you put things that way and make it hard for people to commit crimes, they won't do it. You know, the architects were showing them a better way, but they had to do it in small scale. You can't go to the city and go, let's redesign your, you know, the whole city of, you know, Los Angeles or New York. They have to go into a small area and show this works on a small scale so that you can sell the idea to others. What we have to do with the church is show them a better way on a small scale. They can see in this group that the laws of God held supreme, that we can get along. Okay? We don't have to have police officers here, except for Jason. But yeah, he's accepted. He doesn't have to carry a gun for us, you know, maybe to protect us, but not to protect us from ourselves. Hey, I mean, the ladies get up, they leave their purses on the seat, they don't have to think twice about somebody's going to dip into them, or that you're going to get mugged when you walk out the door by another member of the church. We understand we all are self-governing, that it can work, and we can work. One of the most incredible things I saw, it's on YouTube, of our president, you know, he claims to be a Christian, but he was dissing the Bible. You know, how silly the notions were of the scriptures. And he says, it just doesn't work. Well, what the church does is show that it does work. It's been working in the church for 2,000 years. And it can work for another 2,000. But we have to show the world that. We can't bring the world in here and say, you know, well, obviously the world is better than the church. And then the church becomes, you know, not credible anymore. You know, we're holding people to a higher standard. God is holding us to a higher standard. And we have to hold to it in order to show the world it can be done. That's our responsibility. That's our duty. That's our task as Christians. So I'll just leave it there. If you want to explore this more, I'd be happy to sit down with you. You know, there's classes we can even, you know, teach on it. If at this point, you know, you want to be part of, you know, really a better society that is God's. You know, the opportunity is extended this, you know, very hour. You can become a servant of God, a member of God's church, of his family, of his kingdom. if you're already part of it, you know, the persecutions. Up front, God was, you know, we're going to be persecuted as Christians. No way around it. So we need help. We need to be for one another, and we need God on our side. And a lot of times, it becomes overwhelming. And so if you need the prayers of the congregation or any kind of support or whatever, anything we can do. I mean, this is what we're here for. You know, let your request be made known now as we stand to sing.